Welcome to the Sufi Reverberations podcast, where each week, God willing, you will be able to hear a poem, a story, a meditation, and a musical interlude that give expression to one Sufi's perspective concerning the mystical dimension of Islam. My name is Anab Whitehouse, and I will be your host. Although I am not a sheikh, nonetheless, I did have the opportunity to spend 16 years in the company of a Sufi saint of the 20th century, and by the grace of God, was able to gain a few insights into the nature of the Sufi mystical path through that association. So, without further delay, let's proceed to the essential contents of this episode. Moses said, O Lord of the Day of Account, thou makest forms, wherefore then destroyest thou them? Thou makest charming forms both men and women, wherefore then dost thou lay them waste? God answered, I know that this query of thine proceeds not from negation or vain curiosity, otherwise I should chastise and punish thee. Yea, I should rebuke thee for this question, but thou seekest to discover in my action the ruling principle and the eternal mystery, in order to inform the people thereof, and to make ripe every raw person. Yea, O Messenger, thou questionest me, that I may reveal my ways to the people, though thou knowest them. O Moses, go and sow seed in the ground, in order to do justice to this question. When Moses had sowed and his seed had grown up, he took a sickle and reaped the corn, and then a divine voice reached his ears. Why hast thou sown and nurtured the corn, and then cut it down directly it was ripe? Moses replied, Lord, I cut it and lay it low, because here I have grain and straw. Grain is out of place in the straw yard, and straw is useless in the wheat bin. 'Tis wrong to mix these two. It is needful to sift them one from the other. God said, From whom learnest thou this knowledge, whereby thou hast constructed a threshing floor? Moses said, O Lord, thou hast given me discernment. God said, Then have not I also discernment? Amongst my creatures there are pure spirits and also dark and befouled spirits. The oyster shells are not all of the same value. Some contain pearls and others black stones. It is needful to discern the bad from the good, just as much as to sift wheat from straw. The people of this world exist in order to manifest and to disclose the hidden treasure. Read, I was a hidden treasure and loved to be known. Hide not the hidden treasure, but disclose it. Your true treasure is hidden under a false one, just as butter is hidden within the substance of milk. The false one is this transitory body of yours, the true one, your divine soul. Long time this milk is exposed to view, and the soul's butter is hidden and of no account. Stir up your milk assiduously with knowledge, so that what is hidden in it may be disclosed, because this mortal is the guide to immortality, as the cries of revelers indicate the cupbearer. The foregoing selection is from Book 4 of the Mathnawi of Maulana Jalaluddin Muhammad Rumi, translated and abridged by E. H. Winfield. Today's short story is Curiosity Shop. Most things in life defy full and sometimes even partial explanation. Of course, we have our theories, biases, sciences, theologies, philosophies, ideas, and opinions. But in the end, something always eludes us, and as a result, events often are other than we suppose them to be. For example, there may be certain events which we replay over and over again in our minds, trying to figure out how they came about, or why we, in particular, encountered such happenings, rather than someone else. On a certain level, we know these kinds of events are real because we were there. Yet, we are creatures who tend to be in need of consensual validation. And as a result, when we can't find anyone else to verify that, yes,
such and such an event went on at such and such a time, we become uncertain. We waver between wanting, on the one hand, to hold our existential ground with respect to the proposed reality of an event, and on the other hand, wanting to fold up our tents and disappear into the night, leaving a disputed occurrence to be blown away by the winds of time. Hank Cummings was struggling with just such an event. Via the instant replay machine of his mind, and for the 50th time, he was walking himself through an event, actually several linked events, which had happened to him. At least he thought they had. Tuesday afternoon, following work, he had decided to walk home because it was a beautiful fall day, the kind that makes one glad to be alive. Not that every day shouldn't be viewed that way. Sun was shining, the wind was light, and playfully engaged in a game of tag with the leaves on the ground. The temperature was slightly chilled, but inviting. He remembers walking down Plymouth Avenue and cutting through the market area near Concord Street. He liked this part of the city because it was always so vibrant and filled with interesting places to browse through, and occasionally in which to buy an item or two. Something had drawn his attention to a shop on the corner of Lexington and Green. He had tried to slow down his memory tapes and do a frame-by-frame analysis of this part of things, but no matter how closely he scrutinized the tapes, he really couldn't figure out why he paid any attention to the store at all. There was nothing about its exterior which was remarkable or out of the ordinary. It was just a store like hundreds of others in the area. Yet the next thing he knew, he was inside looking around. Apparently, it was some sort of box store. Hank didn't quite know how else to describe it. Seemingly, there were endless shelves filled with boxes of all different descriptions. Wooden boxes of various sizes, some quite plain and some very ornately decorated or carved, were staring at one from every corner of the store. It was nearly overwhelming. Hank could remember the tightness in his stomach. He always felt this when he walked into a situation which, in some indefinable manner, felt threatening to him. Normally, the sense of vague foreboding would have been enough to make him retreat to the relative safety of the streets. However, resisting the urge to bolt, he stayed and began to wander about the store. There didn't seem to be anyone else in the store, not even a clerk. Perhaps the person or people running the place were in a back room. Consequently, after one box in particular had allured him for an encounter of a closer kind, he was startled when, just as he was about to touch it, a voice from behind said, "That's a very nice piece of workmanship, don't you think?" Inside his consciousness, Hank jumped, but his fright was hardly visible on the surface. Nonetheless, the voice said, "I'm sorry, I've startled you." Hank turned and was face to face with a tall, thin man who seemed to be around 40-something. The man was smiling in an apologetic sort of fashion. The man pointed down to his feet. Hank saw socks, but no shoes. "Very comfortable," the man said. "But sometimes they are too quiet. You are not the first person to have fallen victim to my primitive form of stealth technology." Recovering, Hank smiled and managed, "That's okay." And he returned attention to the box which he had been trying to examine. Hank remembered the man's question and silently agreed that, yes, the craftsmanship of the box was exquisite. Hank had never seen anything quite like it. Still looking at the box, Hank asked over his shoulder, "How much?" "Oh, that one goes for, $10, the shopkeeper replied. Hank turned around again and said, "In view of its quality, that's pretty cheap. How come?" "Well, to be frank with you, sir," the man said, "I was thinking of taking it off the shelf in the next day or so. I don't like to keep boxes hanging around here for more than a day. Whenever boxes remain here too long, I find they sort of lose their usefulness and appeal." You've come at just the right time as far as this box is concerned. It's going at a bargain price. As the man was speaking, Hank's eyes had been glancing at a nearby table laden with several boxes, roughly the same size as the one he liked, and seemingly just as nicely done. "How much for either of those?" Hank inquired, nodding in the direction of the table. The man followed Hank's gaze, paused briefly, and replied, "Each of those goes for $125. Taking a step closer to the table for a more careful look, Hank said, "They all appear to be pretty much the same. Why the price difference?" "Your question is quite reasonable," the man remarked, "but a reasonable answer is much harder to give. Let's just say there are subtle differences between the boxes that would be readily apparent to a trained observer, but not so apparent to someone who is unfamiliar with the story of how those boxes came into being." Hank thought over the man's reply and accepted it, even though he really didn't know what the shopkeeper actually meant. Hank removed his wallet from his jacket pocket and plucked out a $20 bill. "I've got just the place for this box in my living room," Hank said, as he returned his attention to the first box at which he had been looking. He handed the money to the shopkeeper. The man lifted Hank's box off the shelf and carried it over to the cash register. He rang up the purchase, took what was owed from the drawer, and gave the change to Hank. As the man gave Hank his money, the shopkeeper said, "What I'm going to say may sound strange, but you shouldn't open the box until midnight." "Why?" Hank asked. "Will it turn into a pumpkin or something if I do?" "Not quite," the man countered. "However, we have found that customers tend to get their full purchase value only if they follow the instructions accompanying the box. But it's yours now, so you do what you want with it. I'm just trying to offer a helpful suggestion." Actually, Hank hadn't even been thinking about the box's interior. He liked its exterior craftsmanship, and therefore he only had been thinking of putting it in the living room as a piece of art or a conversation piece. The issue of what might be inside the box never crossed his mind. The man said, "Can I put this in a bag for you?" Hank shook his head and responded with, "No, it's fine, as it is. I don't have far to go." The two men exchanged final post-transaction pleasantries, and Hank left the store with the box under his arm. He was home in 10 minutes. He went into the living room and placed the box on the coffee table. Some people had books on the coffee table. He had a box, a very attractive box. He sat on the couch admiring his acquisition. While doing this, a number of thoughts occurred to him. "I wonder what's inside and why I should wait until midnight before opening it. The whole idea of waiting seems ludicrous. What difference could waiting possibly make? Surely whatever is in the box now will be in the box at midnight." Going with his rational judgment, Hank reached out and opened the box. He was unprepared for what happened next. His eyes and nose were assaulted by an array of sensations. Strange colored lights emanated from inside and various kinds of smells as well. The interior of the box seemed to be sectioned off into cubbyhole-like compartments, maybe 20 or more, except that the top of each section was open. Lights were shining from only some of the compartments. When Hank tried to determine the nature of the light source by attempting to probe the open cubby holes with his hand, something prevented him from examining that part of the box, as if there were a force field of some kind in place. Some of the compartments seemed quite dark, a sort of preternatural darkness. When he poked his index finger into one of these holes, that part of his hand seemed to become engulfed in shadows which couldn't be penetrated by normal vision, despite the fact there was still plenty of daylight seeping into the room. He brought his nose down near the box. There was no doubt about it. Some of the compartments had smells and some didn't. The ones that had an aroma rising out of them varied in character. Hank tried to look down into those holes to see what was generating the smell, and he also felt around with some of his fingers, but in neither case could he get to the bottom of things. Some of the compartments had a very pleasant smell, even if he couldn't identify what the smell was. His nose wrinkled with disagreeableness in relation to some of the other holes, and in a few cases his head involuntarily shot back because the stench was so strong. Several of the compartments had a sort of grayish hue to them. When he dipped his index finger into these holes, his fingertip didn't disappear, as is in the case of the black holes, but his fingertip did seem to be washed in a grayish kind of aura. The whole experience was unnerving. Hank didn't have a clue what to make of the situation. He decided to contact his next-door neighbor and have him take a look at things. For whatever reason, events always seem more real when they are shared by two or more people, even when everybody disagrees about what they believe the nature of that commonly held experience might be. He left his house, went to the one on the right, knocked on the door, and waited for the knock to be answered. As he waited, he suddenly remembered his friend had a meeting that night and wasn't going to be home until very late. Hank turned around on the porch of his friend's house, surveyed the neighborhood, and briefly considered going to another house, but rejected the idea. He wouldn't feel comfortable approaching anyone else with this, at least not quite yet. He headed back to his house, went through, closed the front doorway he had left open, and returned to the couch. Hank would wait for his friend and ask him to come over after he got back from his meeting. Throughout the evening, Hank stared at the item on his table. He fixed and ate his supper, hardly tasting anything, preoccupied with his new box the entire time. As the evening wore on, Hank became convinced the box interior was changing in various subtle ways. The lights were altered somehow, and there were a few new smells which were somewhat nondescript in character. Around 11 p.m., Hank saw the lights of his neighbor's car flash past the window as his friend pulled into the garage area. Immediately, Hank jumped up and rushed out of the house, hoping to reach his friend before the latter disappeared into his house. His friend waved to Hank as Hank rounded the corner. Hank merely said, "I need to show you something. Please come with me." His friend was obviously tired, but he trudged along behind Hank, like good friends are sometimes called upon to do. The two men entered Hank's house, and Hank ushered his friend into the living room and pointed to the box on the coffee table. His friend approached the box, picked it up, looked it over for a few moments, and then placed it back on the table. "Nice," he said. "Where did you get it?" Ignoring his friend's query, Hank looked at him and asked, "Do you see anything strange about it? Or do you smell anything out of the ordinary when you're next to the box?" His friend looked at the box and back at Hank. He shook his head. "Not really," he said, and then quickly added, "It's a nicely done box, but that's about as far as it goes." "How would you describe the interior of the box?" Hank inquired nervously. His friend returned his gaze to the box and studied it for a few seconds. Shrugging, he said, "There are a bunch of compartments," he paused and said. "Am I missing something here?" Hank was lost in thought. He came out of his reverie long enough to smile, somewhat embarrassedly, replying, "No, it just must be me. I thought there was something odd about the box and wanted to get your take on it, and that's all. It's just one of those things, I guess. I'm sorry to have dragged you over here." As an afterthought and a way of changing focus, Hank asked, "How'd your meeting go?" His friend rolled his eyes and smiled. "You know meetings. They go on forever and never seem to accomplish much except paving the way for further meetings. I think meetings use humans to make other meetings possible, like flowers use bees." His friend waved goodbye to Hank and said, "I can show myself out, thanks." Hank gave a weak imitation of a wave and watched his friend leave. He sat on the couch looking at the box again and sniffing at it here and there. The smells were still there, but the lights had nearly vanished. In addition, Hank noticed that most of the areas which previously seemed to be protected by some sort of force field were now accessible to him. Most of these compartments had become dusted with a grayish tinge, similar to the aura that characterized a number of the other compartments earlier. Suddenly, Hank was very tired. He gave one last long look at the box and then went off to bed. When Hank awoke the next morning, he rushed downstairs to view his box. It was pretty much as he had left it last night, except that now all the lights had disappeared, leaving only the smells. Hank dressed quickly, picked up the box, and headed for the store where he had purchased it. He covered the distance quickly and entered the shop and saw the same man who had assisted him the previous day sweeping the store floor. The man acknowledged his entrance, noted the box beneath his arm, and continued to sweep. Finally, the shopkeeper said, "Can I help you with anything?" Hank put the box down on the counter and said, "So what's going on?" The man went behind the counter and commented, "I take it, against advice, you opened the box before midnight. Is that right?" he said, with one eyebrow raised as if a prosecutor were making a charge. Momentarily flustered with the man's question, Hank hemmed and hawed. Shortly later, he confessed. The man waved his hand in a dismissive way. "Well, there's no real harm done, but I warned you about not getting full value for your money." Hank was mystified. Again, he asked, "What's going on?" Finally, the dam broke and a flood of questions burst forth. "What is this all about? Why am I apparently the only one who can see the lights and smell the aromas rising out of the box? Why can I put my fingers in some of the compartments and not others? And why does the box appear to change? What does it all mean?" The man had an amused expression on his face, followed by a mock sense of surprise as he said, "My, my, so many questions." The shopkeeper took the box, which Hank had brought with him, and threw it into a collection bin, commenting, as he did this, "I guess you're all through with this one." Hank was upset. "Wait, what are you doing? That's my box. Why are you throwing it out?" "Don't worry," said the man. "I'll give you a discount on your next box." The shopkeeper stopped, hesitated, and then asked cautiously, "You do want another one, don't you?" "Not without an explanation, I don't," Hank said defiantly. "Very well," the man said. "What do you want to know?" "Everything," demanded Hank. The shopkeeper shook his head and replied, "Sorry, I don't know everything. I can only tell you what I know. You'll have to be satisfied with that." Hank thought this over and said, "All right, tell me what you know." The man shook his head again. "Sorry, I'm not allowed to tell you everything I know. I can only tell you some things." Frustrated, Hank exploded, "Then for God's sake, tell me what you can." A very pleased expression came over the man's face. "I would be happy to do that," he said. Clearing his throat, the shopkeeper began, "This box has 24 compartments. Each compartment contains 1 hour of your life. If you had waited until midnight, the box would have had 24 fresh opportunities shining forth for you to take advantage of. But since you opened the box prematurely, the box could only show what was left of your day and what already had transpired. You couldn't access certain areas of the box because that time was not yet yours. Those compartments glowed with the light of potential, but otherwise were off limits to you. The black holes which you saw give expression to the time when you were sleeping and doing nothing with the time allotted you. The gray tinged areas encompass the times when you did nothing with the hours of the day to either help or hurt your seeking to realize the purpose of your life. And since last night you wasted a lot of time just looking at the box and wondering about things, there are a lot of gray areas in your box. The smells coming from the box constitute the things you have done throughout the day, which have either aided the purpose of your life or have served to undermine it. If you think back to what took place yesterday and are honest with yourself, I believe you will be able to map various smells onto different deeds which you did during those particular hours. As far as why no one but you can see what is in the box is concerned, well, they are your hours, after all, aren't they? You're responsible for them, and out of courtesy, certain forces are present which help keep those contents hidden from the view of others. But the smells, well, sometimes even these can't be camouflaged. And I should warn you that under certain circumstances, those smells may follow a person through eternity. The man smiled in summation, adding, "So, would you like to get another box for tomorrow, or would you prefer another bargain box like you purchased yesterday, the kind with respect to which you don't follow instructions and therefore lose the value of the box?" The shopkeeper's eyebrows were both raised to punctuate his question. Hank stood in a sort of stupor. He was nonplussed by the whole situation. The man noted Hank's condition and said, "If you purchase something other than one of our daily bargains, there are different costs associated with any of the selections which you might make. If I were you, I would choose very carefully." The following entry for today's edition of the musical interlude section of the podcast is called Curiosity. From the deepest recesses of the Orono Bog Walk in Orono, Maine, you are listening to the Sufi Reverberations Podcast. This week's edition of Meditative Essays is entitled Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah, all praise belongs to God. This seems to be a very easy precept to understand, but in practice, it is a perspective which is frequently, if not usually, misunderstood and forgotten. Of course, from time to time, we may pause to give praise to God, and some of the time we may even, however briefly, mean it. Nonetheless, the nature of the ego is such that we really don't like sharing the spotlight with God, let alone acknowledge that God and God alone is behind every manner of event or process to which praise should be accorded. Much of the world's activities are built around ideas of winners and losers, elites and commoners, rich and poor, talented and untalented, intelligent and unintelligent, leaders and followers, movers and shakers, or the moved and the shaken, insiders and outsiders, the beautiful and the ugly, successes and failures, competence and incompetence, the chosen and the cast out. The list could be extended. People who, for example, are talented, intelligent, competent, successful leaders often feel they deserve whatever rewards and kudos come to them. After all, isn't this merely a matter of cause and effect in which the superior being asserts himself or herself or themselves and reaps the benefits of that superiority? If someone were to suggest that we all, no matter what our standing in life, are merely role players, and perhaps not even that, in a cosmic passion play in which the role associated with our being is less important than our understanding of how that role fits into the overall scheme of things, many people might begin to feel a little uncomfortable. This is so because the foregoing orientation would seem to diminish, if not nullify altogether, all of our quote-unquote accomplishments in life. Many people root their identities in what supposedly their accomplishments tell the world and themselves about the sort of people they are and from what kind of cloth they are cut. Consequently, the idea we are not the ones who are really responsible for our accomplishments becomes very threatening and disorienting. In fact, in the passion play of life, not only is it the case that we are not the architects of our successes, it is also the case that not everything means what conventional wisdom supposes things to mean. The passion play is also a mystery. In such a passion play, quote-unquote success does not necessarily mean success, and quote-unquote failure does not necessarily mean one has failed. In such a passion play, there may be an inversion of what we take to be the meaning of events, such that, for instance, riches sometimes may really signify impoverishment, or that which is considered to be beautiful actually may be, under certain circumstances, ugly. In such a passion play, the meaning of things is a function of the intentions and purposes of central casting. Moreover, such meaning is not a matter of the values which we may arbitrarily assign to the roles we play. We do not earn our talent or intelligence or beauty or wealth or power or success. These are assigned to us, much as an actor is given a costume to wear. However, in the passion play of life, we are not really even actors. We are more like the rack on which the costume is hung, while waiting for the actor or actress to perform at the appropriate time. In any event, if an actress or actor in a movie begins to believe that she or he was the role being played, we might think this to be indicative of a mental illness of some sort. On the other hand, because most of us suffer from deep spiritual illnesses, we do not consider our identification with the roles assigned to us in the play of life to be aberrant. Yet in reality, as indicated above, We are not even the costumes worn by the actors and actresses in the play, let alone the players. Moreover, the qualities associated with those assigned roles, qualities such as intelligence, wealth, beauty, success, and so on, are all props which will revert to the prop master at the conclusion of the play. They do not belong to us. The qualities are all borrowed. They are all part of the process of creating the illusion of life's passion play. If the script, roles, costumes, special effects, lighting, and so on of life are all the work of some other order of level of reality, then accepting credit for any of this seems rather fraudulent. Yet whenever we accept praise on a personal level, rather than remembering to whom praise ought to be directed, then we are acting fraudulently, whether we are aware of it or not. We are trying to deceive others or ourselves that we are fit objects of praise, and this simply is not and cannot be the case. We are an audience invited to witness, as participant observers of sorts, the unfolding of a passion play. If we are witnessing and participating in this process of virtual reality in the appropriate way, we will be applauding with intention rather than action the one who is producing, directing, filming, casting, writing, staging, and reviewing the play. Our responsibilities in this matter involve the attitudes, opinions, intentions, understandings, and identifications which are formed through us during the course of that play. The Sufi is someone who is attempting to inculcate a constant awareness within himself or herself or themselves of the abiding truth of the statement, all praise is due to God. The Sufi is attempting to become, so to speak, supersaturated with the realization of how God is organizing, shaping, directing, producing, and scripting one's life. With God's blessings, the Sufi is struggling towards a deepening understanding of and appreciation concerning the multiplicity of ways in which God is present in one's day-to-day life. If God grants success in the foregoing endeavors, the Sufi comes to know God is never absent from one's life. The individual also comes to understand the following. Only because of our tendency to be absent from God do we fail to recognize the divine presence in all things, and how this presence gives expression to the incontrovertible character of all praise is due to God. Alhamdulillah. You have been listening to the Sufi Reverberations podcast. I hope you will join me next week for a new episode of this program. May peace be your companion.